in that outlines all the work. That as well, I think, we'll be putting before the members to go through, and maybe if there are some additions that the members want to do, if there are things that they really want to engage on, we will be available to actually be part of the engagement, so that it is a report that can be adopted as our annual report in terms of what we did and in terms of what we have exhausted for the year 2010. So those are the two other reports that you can further look into. But the set of minutes, honourable members, as it was repeated, I would like to take the members through the set of minutes so that we can see if there are corrections, there are amendments, and we then have them adopted for the day, for this day, and we finalize our minutes, except the 2 days minutes that might come later, and we will consider them with this report that has come. We don't have hangover from 2011. Okay, the first set of minutes will be that one of the 15th of September 2010. Do you all have copies, one of them, remember? Yeah. It's only a copy. Our agenda still remains for today. We will have a presentation for public service. They will be outlining process report on delivered agreement outcome 12. So that will still happen for today after we've gone through our minutes. We will still have the outline of the bill, and we'll leave it to the department to actually indicate where they are. We'll take it up from the presentation that will be done. So our agenda remains as outlined. And that is the last agenda item for the committee work this year, except the fact that there will be other things that we'll be doing, like getting involved in the anti-corruption campaign. We might have also, if there's a need, we might have other meetings where we focus on particular issues, but that will be if there's a need to do that. Otherwise, we'll follow the program of Parliament, like in terms of where we are. On the minutes, then, of the 15th, any corrections on page 1? Honorable Williams?
I was going to move for the adoption of these minutes. I've read them, and there's no problem for that.
No problem. Go through. Okay. Okay. Unfortunately, your proposal falls off. Okay, page 1 of the minute. Page 2. And the last page. Any second? Thank you. That's the person who is adopted. Oh, no, there is that after the adoption of the meeting.
Yes.
Okay.
The rising.
Wonderful. Okay.
Point 5. The mention of the PricewaterhouseCoopers forensic report on the PCTA. Can I just inquire whether we actually managed to get hold of a copy of that report?
Okay, yeah, we'll report on that. Yes. Maybe let's just talk about that because it's also a matter rising on, so that when we finish with this, we'll also finish with that matter. It was another tedious matter. We still have our legal advisor, she attended even this meeting on that matter, because it was one matter that we worked on. After we sorted out legal advice, there was a legal outline in terms of how the process goes, and we really appreciate the service that we were offered. And we were also going to put it to the attention of the speaker if it wasn't really going to happen. It was already there, but indirectly on us, but putting it to the speaker's attention so that if the speaker knows exactly what happened, if that process had failed, Fortunately, the process hasn't failed after it received that attention. The report had been sent because we gave a deadline of 2 days. Yes, because our opinion was that if we closed on the 5th of November and that matter was never dealt with, it means we failed. And therefore, we needed to take other measures. And safe to say now, the report had been sent just today to Reza, and we do have it with us. It wasn't an easy one. Also, yes, such that there's huge correspondence that relates to that, including the legal ones. Okay, yeah. So,
Jay, can I just say congratulations on a job well done after months, but for the perseverance. And I hope we'll all get copies in the course of the day. Fantastic. Thank you.
Yes, I would really like to thank the whole team that was into making sure the report is there. So, thank you very much. Okay, we'll proceed to the next set of minutes. We start with page one. It's the minutes on the 19th of October. Page two. Page three. And page four. Any move for the adoption of the minutes? Moved by Honorable Bikani. Any seconder? Seconded by Honorable Bishop. Thank you. Comrades, we are then finished with the minutes. And then let me just outline the report that we have, like what I did indicate. Can I then request on the two reports that I already outlined that the members go through and we will be available? Would need to make sure that you finalize. Well, I would say maybe when we meet, it would be good if we get some contributions or issues that the members have met and discussed. When we are going to meet, I hope the committee will all make it for Thursday. And it will be important maybe to assess how many of us will be able to be part of the anti-corruption launch. But I also advise that if members want to do some submissions, that will be better. We can be able to collate information and sort of do it on that day or even a day before. So as I know, this means we'll just make a round assessment who will be able to make it for the anti-corruption launch. The next item on the agenda is the presentation on the progress report on the delivery agreement of outcome 12 to need that November. What I just needed to amplify and clarify is that it's not a new presentation. It was presented to us, you know, and there was a commitment done to the committee that as a department to commit ourselves to do all these things. This is how we're going to do it. But further than that, we had some reports. We had a report from the Public Service Commission that was outlining some of the weaknesses, which when we discuss ourselves as members, when we look at this outcome and progress report, we shouldn't forget also what came before us. In addition, we also had another Auditor General report. So we therefore have to draw a link. Otherwise, if we think the Auditor General is separate from privacy and it's separate from what the department is saying, we might miss out in terms of you know, the gaps that are there. We therefore have to factor in all the information that we have as a committee. And acting DG, as we'd be doing Kenny Govenda, we would also be noting all those aspects and want to believe the department is ready has also looked into that in that way. So I am going to hand over, because the copies are already here with us, I'm going to hand over to Kenny Govenda to proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm going to cover two aspects as per the request from the committee today. There's more progress reports in terms of the delivery agreement for outcome 12, but I'm also going to deal in terms of the processes linked to the integrated single public service in relation to that bill. You'll notice today I've decided to approach the presentation slightly differently. The last presentation we did in August was the presentation with the full tables, which gave the objectives, which gave the indicators. Indicating I've decided to approach the presentation more from the perspective of outcome 12 rather than looking at the annual performance plans of DPSA as a department, but looking broader in terms of the work DPSA does. So if I look at slide 2 in terms of the presentation, I'm going to focus on the background in relation to outcome 12 and then building on from the July processes, the finalization of the delivery agreement itself, the efficiency, and then I've selected key areas that I thought is important for us to focus on rather than the entire shopping list that DPSA deals with. And in that regard, we're looking at the efficiency and effectiveness of the public service under one of those key outputs, and there's a range of sub-projects or sub-outputs in this regard. We're looking at the anti-corruption capacity, as well as the CETA turnaround strategy. Those are some of the key areas that seem to come up quite often, and let's focus on those in terms of the presentation. And as I indicated, I'm going to conclude with the integrated or the single public service bill. Just to remind ourselves quickly, outcome 12, the outcome is defined as an efficient, effective, and development-oriented public service and an empowered, fair, and inclusive citizenship. You'll notice today as well in the presentation, I'm not looking at the second part of it, which deals with an empowered, fair, and inclusive citizenship. That particular activity is driven, or which we normally call Part B of Outcome 12, is driven by the Department of Arts and Culture, and the Minister for Arts and Culture drives that particular aspect. Continuing with the outputs, there's 7 outputs to outcome 12, and the first one deals with service delivery quality and access, human resource management and development, business process, systems, decision rights and accountability, and finally, corruption tackled effectively, which is defined as part A of the outcome 12. And then part B, which is the empowered fair citizenship, covers the following 3 outputs. One is nation building and national identity. The second one deals with citizen participation, and then finally social cohesion. Just to indicate where we are, the delivery agreement was signed on the 14th of October 2010 and included the following delivery partners. Ministers, 8 ministers signed, 4 of them are still outstanding, and we're in the process of finalizing those 4 signatures. With regard to premiers, 6 have signed, 3 are outstanding. Again, it's simply a process issue to try and finalize. Seems like we've lost the feed again. We need to also indicate that the delivery agreement itself, as we indicate, delivery agreements is not minister-specific. It involves a range of ministers to ensure you have the outcome that you want to achieve, and the delivery partners are then those ministers identified. For example, with outcome 12, we've identified as delivery partners minister in the presidency, Minister Chabane. We've identified the Minister of Arts and Culture in relation to outcome 12, Part B. We've identified ministers of basic education, ministers of health, ministers of home affairs. So there's a range of ministers that we've identified that should be partners in the process. And as I go through the presentation, you'll also pick up why we've identified those ministers. We also need to indicate that the delivery agreement is aligned with the performance agreement signed with the President in April 2010. That is the agreement signed between the Minister and President. It is also aligned to the work emanating from the President's meeting. During the course of this year, in April, the President met with senior officials in government, that is your DGs and DDGs at a national level. Arising from that particular meeting, we constituted a task team with a range of activities to be addressed. So all of those issues that emanated from that meeting have been now incorporated into outcome 12 to be dealt with. And finally, the annual performance plan of DPSA has been aligned with the delivery agreement to ensure that the work we do at the delivery agreement is the same work we do in the department. It's not duplication, or it's not activities that are seen additional to the work DPSA does, or it doesn't fall through the cracks. Let's take the first one, and as said, I've just clustered them into three broad areas that I want to focus on. If one looks at the efficiency and effectiveness of the public service, and that covers largely the first three outputs in relation to service delivery, access to service delivery, it covers the second one, which deals with human resource, and the third area deals with processes and business processes in the public service. In this regard, we've identified the following problem statements. Firstly, the difficulty in terms of meeting public's expectation and satisfaction, which has declined from 75% in 2006 to 58% in 2008, based on some of the research findings that we've done, including research findings from the Public Service Commission. It's interesting to know those figures are showing an increase in the recent report issued by the Public Service Commission. But that was one of the key areas we identified, and we said whatever we do, we need to turn that around. It needs to increase back to 75 and beyond if possible. The second problem statement, government services are still not equally accessible to all South Africans, especially those in rural areas. Appropriate implementation of legislation and regulatory frameworks is still of a concern in the public service in particular. Enforcement of compliance is still lacking across the public service, and I think we've picked that up in presentation by the Auditor General in the previous presentations as well. Training model for the public service, in particular the transformation or the repositioning of Palama, is a concern and something we need to focus on. The other area that was picked up was the protected disciplinary processes, and some of the examples that In terms of the research that was conducted, 21 departments that were sampled, 50% of them take longer than 106 days to finalize any disciplinary matter that features before the department. And of the 369 that are on precautionary suspension, it's cost government as a whole approximately 45.7 million rand. For the period April 2009 to March 2010. And we said that's an area we need to address speedily. The question then arises, what is our response? And this is clearly captured in the delivery agreement. And our response from government as a whole, in terms of outcome 12, we want to conduct user satisfaction surveys with the view of improving user satisfaction levels from 58 to 75. Remember, the surveys is just simply one mechanism to test levels of satisfaction. We need to do a whole range of other activities to improve the manner in which we provide services. And those are some of the areas we've identified. We need to improve access to government services by developing norms and standards for maximum distance traveled to obtain a service, and we're doing that jointly with DPSA, DHA, Department of Home Affairs, and Stats South Africa. We need to improve recruitment, retention, and career pathing, including conducting a personal expenditure review, ensure that all vacant posts are filled within 4 months, thereby reducing vacancy rate to around 10%. At the moment, the average vacancy rate, based on the statistics on the PASAL system, is around 19-odd% in general, but in certain categories, it goes up to 40%. So it depends on the figures one uses. The response also says we need to improve the discipline management by improving the regulatory environment as well as the turnaround times to 60 days. Improve the extent and depth of skills in the public service by developing mandatory training programs and to be rolled out by Palama. Develop and implement an appropriate training model with Palama at the center. The idea of Palama at the center, we also recognize that we have a number of provincial academies. So we need to create partnerships between Palama at the center and their provincial academies and the relationship between the two in terms of the types of training that needs to be done. Then finally, in relation to this particular area, what is the progress? How far have we gone to date in trying to respond adequately to those problem statements I've identified? Firstly, we've drafted a methodology for user satisfaction surveys, and it has been developed and is being consulted with delivery partners, so that's GCIS, that's South Africa and Offices of the Premier. We've drafted and access norms to government services, and it's been developed by Basic Education, Home Affairs, Stats of Africa, and Stats. It's done together with the geographical information system that we have in DPSA, quite a comprehensive one in terms of all of the various services that are provided by government and their locations across the board. Departments providing essential services are recruiting frontline supervisory staff to improve responsiveness. DPSA is developing a web-based system to monitor compliance with the signing of performance agreements by SMS. We're in the process of defining the user requirements. A draft principles of public administration and financial delegations have been developed by DPSA, and it's being consulted with departments. We're doing two things in this regard. We're using the draft to consult, but we're also using the draft to assist departments in designing their own delegations at the departmental level. Consultation on the mandatory training programs has commenced. Excuse me. The process of refining the draft list of programs is currently underway, and that's jointly with Palama. Continuing with the progress, we are currently working with the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation in the development of an institutional performance system, which will be used to inform heads of departments' performance and development going forward. The idea is also to relocate the assessment of heads of departments to the Department of PME away from the public administration, but that's still being discussed as well. Preliminary work on the review of the recruitment practices in the public service has been completed, and a report has been drafted with a set of recommendations to help us improve recruitment in the public service. Train the trainer labor relations module has been developed. It's been piloted and tested in a number of departments. We've now handed it over to Palama to convert it into unit standards for them to start the process of rollout. A set of proposals and recommendations developed for consultation on reducing the period it takes to finalize disciplinary cases. We've done a comprehensive analysis of the management of discipline in the public service, and it was done together with all of the practitioners in the field. What we did there is we tried to avoid going to managers and going to legal representatives or going to anyone else. We brought in all of the practitioners, people on the field dealing with discipline, and we asked them what the problems were, and we tried to find a way of how to address them. We've come up with a comprehensive document which defines a refined process as well as the need to amend certain pieces of regulations, and that document is now on its way for consultation. The HR Connect project is well underway, and a further 44 departments during the course of this year have been taken on board. The only outstanding departments are in Western Cape, and Western Cape has written to us to delay the implementation due to internal reorganizational issues. So we will start in February 2011 with 5 departments, and then April 2011 with the remaining 8 departments in Western Cape. So all 13 of them will be on board by April 2011. We are currently working jointly with Health and National Treasury to develop generic organizational structures for Provincial Department of Health. We've already designed and developed one which has been approved for the Mpumalanga Department of Health. The idea now is to test that particular generic structure and to implement it across the board in all provincial health departments. By the way, we've been also requested by Department of Education to assist them in developing a similar generic structure for departments of education at a provincial level. The personal cleanup is currently underway and the process has commenced. The next area to focus on is the anti-corruption capacity. And again, I think we've spent lots of time in doing this presentation, so I'm going to go through it fairly quickly. What is the problem statement? Firstly, there is a perception of corruption in the public service. We use the word perception because there's no concrete evidence as to the extent of corruption in the public service, although there's widespread reporting and there's clear messages out there. So it's an area that we need to tackle. And as government, we've taken seriously with the view of tackling seriously as well. There is great frustration about the delayed responses of departments in fighting corruption, especially in managing conflict of interest and tender irregularities. In cases whereby wrongdoing is identified, sometimes it takes several months for disciplinary process to be initiated as well as finalized. It's interesting, what departments tend to do, in terms of the legal provisions, departments must initiate a process within 60 days if you suspend somebody. Departments normally do that initiation within 60 days. And then while it's in the disciplinary process itself, it's then delayed for up to a year or 2 years based on requests from department or individual for continuous postponement. And we say we need to look at that loophole in the current regulatory environment. How do we manage the time frames to reduce it to 60 days? Officials are often suspended on full pay for months and sometimes for years. Significant inconsistencies in the type of sanctions applied for similar offenses. You'll have a case where an individual for the first time has stolen a ream of paper, and that individual is fired or dismissed with immediate effect. And on the other hand, you'll get an individual who's been involved in fraud and could run into hundreds of thousands of rands, and the individual gets a final written warning. So we've seen inconsistencies in the application of some of these things across the board. And we're trying to come up with some degree of uniformity in the application of sanctions. Allegations of corruption reported to the anti-corruption hotline are also referred back to departments for follow-up. But because departments do not have sufficient investigative capacity, initial investigations are never completed. And therefore, the individual remains on suspension with no charges being levied against the individual. What is our response? Firstly, we need to build anti-corruption capacity through the establishment of the Special Anti-Corruption Unit. As the Chair has indicated, that unit will be launched on Thursday, the 25th of November. We need to implement the Public Sector Integrity Management Framework in the whole of government. Our view is you cannot simply try and deal with corruption from one perspective, and that is after a crime has been committed. You need now to address that through a disciplinary process. We strongly believe you need to tackle it from both ways. You need to also prevent corruption. You need to also promote ethical behavior in the public service. And therefore, we want to focus lots of our energy around building a public service that functions with integrity and is ethical in its behavior towards the public and in the way they do business. There's a need to establish an interministerial committee that will ensure coordination of the efforts of government as a whole, as well as the multi-agency working group has been established to deal with fraud and corruption in the procurement processes, as well as public sector anti-corruption capacity building program. In other words, training people to become more vigilant in the way they manage some of these things. What is the progress to date? The concept document for the establishment of the Special Anti-Corruption Unit has been completed. The proposed structure of the unit has been approved by the Minister for Public Service and Administration. We are currently in the process of appointing relevant skilled personnel into this unit. We've established a working relationship with the Special Investigative Unit, the SIU, who will provide to this unit both investigative, prosecutorial, as well as training services to ensure that the skills and the capacity of the members of the unit are of the appropriate level. The unit will be launched on the 25th of November 2010. Training for general employees has been conducted in 6 provinces, and 320 employees have been trained to date. The Public Sector Integrity Management Framework has been drafted. Further consultations on the framework will take place on the 25th of November. The program for the 25th of November covers consultation on the Public Sector Integrity Management Framework as well as the launch of the unit going forward. Finally, with regard to progress on anti-corruption capacity, BUSA, Business Unity South Africa training program commenced in July in Mpumalanga and Gauteng. We've drafted a public service pledge, which we hope to test as part of the public sector integrity management framework. The IFMS project, the Integrated Financial Management System, the HR module, has been designed to include the capturing of financial disclosure forms and to track disciplinary cases linked to corruption. The phase two report was approved by the OECD Working Group on Bribery in International Business Transactions, and that is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The action plan arising from that phase two report has been developed, has been approved by the Interministerial Committee, and is currently on its way to Cabinet for final approval. We will be subject to an assessment in 2012 in terms of the final phase of that assessment. The first meeting of the Implementation Review Group, and this is part of the United Nations Convention on Anti-Corruption, took place in Vienna. South Africa has been selected to be reviewed in 2012 as part of the United Nations Convention on Anti-Corruption. The final area is the CETA turnaround strategy. The problem statement deals with the efficiency and effectiveness of CETA, the stability of the organization, poor procurement practices and governance, inconsistent and high cost of acquisitions of ICT products and services, execution of regulatory functions, employer of choice in the industry. What has been the response? We needed to finalization of the CETA turnaround strategy, and that strategy needs to cover the following six areas. Be the proficient lead agency in public sector ICT, effective and integrated public sector supply chain management, competitive pricing and financial stability, effective ICT regulator, effective governance and monitoring, employer of choice in the ICT industry. The response must also address strengthening of CETA governance structures in the executive, as well as the review of the procurement processes and pricing model of CETA. What is the progress to date? CETA turnaround strategy has been completed. The full board is now fully constituted. Executive management appointments are ongoing. I'm sure many of the members would have picked up in the newspapers of 2 weeks. All six of the executive management positions have been advertised, including the CEO. The COO has been appointed, the chief operating officer. Implementing the strategy and attending to the Auditor General's audit is a process that's ongoing and closely monitored by the board. Operating costs have largely been contained through the cost containment exercise that they put in place. Operationalizing stakeholder relationship management, including visits of the Portfolio Committee to CETA, parliamentary engagement, the GovTech 2010, which was successfully hosted during the course of this year, international stakeholder engagements are taking place as well. They've developed a costing and pricing policy to guide competitive pricing, engagement with vendors to reduce costs as part of the cost containment drive, as well as the CETA has implemented management of current contracts with suppliers. In the past, these contracts simply ran their course, extended, just updated. The process is now where they're engaging and trying to get the best cost benefit to the organization and to departments. One of the core objectives of establishing CETA was to use economy of scale and cost to government as a whole. In conclusion, Madam Chair and Honourable Members, just to deal with the process map with regard to the draft legislation for integrated or single public service.
I don't know if should we divide the discussion or you think
one slide.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, proceed.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It's just one slide in terms. Sorry.
Okay, let's leave the slide, Mr. Kovenda. Let's just focus on this. You know, even if it's just one summarized information, we'll come to that. But at this point in time, I think, honorable members, there is a presentation that is already done on the table. Can we then engage with that discussion as it was done? We have noted that it's done in terms of a problem statement and progress. Like I indicated, let's take on board all things that came to our attention. And we're starting with Honorable William.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to talk about on the outcome 12. You said acting DG, that A and B were divided. You said there were two parts, and B was driven by arts and culture. And under B is public participation. And I was just wondering, why is public participation being put with arts and culture? I mean, this is a core principle of this administration, public participation. You know, the NDR was driven with the desire to have public participation. So I just want some clarity around that. Secondly, I'd also like to know about outcome 12, section A. It says on the seven outputs for outcome 12, and the first output is service delivery quality and access. And there's been no mention of the Tucson centers and what's happening there and how are they being put into this, because they're very, very important, and it seems to be they've just been completely ignored here. Thank you.
I don't know, before you actually respond, because I don't see any other hand. We are actually engaging with this, and maybe one has to just find out. We need to start to discuss, you know, what's the point that Honorable Williams has raised on public participation is very critical, and I know many instances public safety and administration does touch on the issues. There are some days where we do, and you know, the focus in terms of even the impact in terms of how people perceive the services that they acquire. We also need to look at it in relation to Parliament itself, you know, in terms of public participation. You know, who is actually responsible? I would actually know that public safety and administration in terms of training the civil servants, that is the responsibility of public safety and administration, but it would be a bit confusing because we don't have a CETA. For instance, I would think even in terms of CETA, perhaps when we talk PCTA, it relates to also quality assurance along that line. But now, we don't have a CETA for the legislature. That's the other thinking. Perhaps we need to talk about it, you know, because it's still located in government. And the public participation, we don't really teach our citizens even to value their flag, to know what has been done for them, you know, to understand what are their rights and their responsibilities. We haven't started to talk about it quite concretely. It's a very serious thing. And also to start to say, how is it located? There are outcomes, you know, what you're doing. There's other things we can do to a particular area, but it's best one. We start to give it, to discuss about it broader, so that we locate what is supposed. We also talk about the transformation of Parliament, you know, how the kind of Parliament we want to see, and so on and so on. So maybe when you discuss about it, let's just open up to a thorough discussion. Give us part of your sight so that we can look broadly in terms of how to move forward. Is there any other hand, perhaps, before I revert back to Mr. Govenda? Dr. Van Skalvik, and I've seen another hand. Yes, Honorable Nyakembe, I've seen your hand as well. And Honorable Bikan, in that order, Honorable Van Skalvik.
Thank you. Jay, I was just wondering, DG, that one of the problem statements is that there is still a lack of government accessibility in the rural areas. How are we going to solve that? Will Tucson centers play an important role there? Thanks.
Another one again, please.
Thank you very much. I think the first point for me is that I want to speak on anti-corruption. Acknowledging also the fact that the minister did brief us, and you indicated, Chair, that there's a launch on Thursday. But in the problem statement, I think it's slide 10, where you are indicating that it takes a lot of time to finalize disciplinary processes if then there are wrongdoings that have been identified that subject an official to disciplinary processes. Now the I know you as a department you are intending to shorten the time. Obviously that has an impact in the current disciplinary procedures and policies. Are the trade unions engaged in these attempts, one, of trying to shorten the time in terms of the disciplinary processes, and secondly, because unions do talk about corruption, do you as a department also try to check with the unions as to what strategies or tactics that the union say need to be applied in order to deal with this? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Vigani.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think overall the report is very, very satisfactory in the sense that we are now slowly integrating and centralizing the issues to be at a point so that you can see implementation processes. Thanks, Mr. Governor. That's now a few areas of focus that I think we should also then go into is, okay, the anti-corruption processes, I think it's more than efficient that there's going to be a launch and there are systems now in place. But even there, I think there should be a commitment that there should be continuous reporting, if possible, on a quarterly basis on the development based from the launch that will be taking place. I think it's around the 25th or something like that, so that we can see if there's a reduction in corruptive practices in the public sector. Then the issue I want to come to is the issue of training, the training academy, and in particular public services CETA. I don't know, but I'm not yet satisfied with the way we are positioning ourselves as having PCTA as a public service and administration entity. There's a lot that still gaps in terms of us getting a grip or a hold in them accounting to us. And as much as we know that they are now under administration, but even there I think we'd need more detail in terms of progress as to where they are now. Because you can't tell me that rolling out training programs, especially those that are going to claim from the very public services CETA at a stagnant stage. Oh, okay. So I think really even what you just suggested, what you mentioned earlier in terms of the CETA for governance and legislatures should be key to DPSA to actually take into cognizance as to what format that could take. I think it will also make a difference in terms of the gaps we are facing in capacity and making a move on main training issues that are needed for the particular sectors. Then the other issue is that you mentioned something in the report of training with BUSA. I'm just worried that we are so trying so hard to see that the centralized training towards Palama, how involved are these guys with Palama? The issue of centralizing training must be a consistency. It shouldn't be an issue that you find that it's when it's convenient it's used, or when the committee requests certain things, then it's convenient to say Palama is becoming a central body. And yet now I can see from this that there's other trainings that are going on, but with little evidence indicating that the decentralization sector is still being maintained towards Palama, and also in encouraging that the PC to become involved with Palama and all the sectors of the public sector heading towards Palama. Then the other area I'd like to comment on is the human resource management and the IFMS, the alignment of systems. I feel that even there too, we can once again picking up that this IFMS thing is continuing. And I think the last time there was a special request we made that before we get left behind too far, can we get an indication of the actual operational as well as the strategy plan of this IFMS as to who's heading it, where is it starting, where is it at this point in time. We are aware that there has been funding for this IFMS for a couple of years now, even before we came into Parliament. But for some reason or the other, it's a matter that keeps on slipping away from us in terms of the actual details of this program and how it's being run. And the reason for that is that the human resource management sectors are experiencing great difficulties, operational difficulties in human resource management issues. One of them in particular, not forgetting the lessons we learned from the strike, the past strike that took place, there's a lot of issues that need to be ironed out in terms of the the salaries of public servants in particular. There is an indication there's a lot of irregularities. Yes, they're saying they're working on the personnel system. But you, again, are saying to us that the developments in the personnel system are continuing. And yet it was an indication that you can't continue with the personnel system without deploying it into the actual overall ISMS system. You can't let it run on its own. And if you're saying that there are gaps and negative gaps, how then are you saying that you're going to run ahead with the personnel system without putting the whole ISMS into cooperation? I'm having a bit of a problem there as to your coordination factor is still not clear. Especially, there's also what you mentioned, that saying the trainer in the LR, labor relations modules. Once again, how connected or how centralized or how driven towards the center is it, which in this instance we mentioned that it should be Palama. So if you can just cap up the HRM and IFMS system such that they are visibly operating under one umbrella to roll out then and become decentralized to the provinces. Then the CETA chairperson, what is there beyond the hotline integration system? Because I think the CETA should be more involved in each of the departments in terms of their systems. But beyond the hotline, what's going on within the CETA to indicate that work is also being centralized? Then I still maintain, Chair, we are still not receiving the regional report. There's no details of the functions of the regions. And I raise that almost in every meeting concerning CETA issues, that the regional offices, I get a feeling, are not properly supervised by the CETA itself. They are not. And the operations and how functionality is taking place in those offices is yet to be answered. Those details are still not coming out. Then, of course, the public participation and outreach programs from DPSA, can that also become more visible, especially to assist with the issue that was mentioned of the Tucson centers and the constituency offices in particular? We should come to a point now where we start seeing programs being rolled out from a center and all participants for outreach programs and oversight having a common understanding as to what is there that can be what you call an outreach for the community from DPSA. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, you want to add something,
Honorable Nikam?
Yeah.
Yes. That's one point, Chair. The issue of the public sector education and training authority is consistently coming up. And what I want to find out, Honorable Chairperson, is that has the department, because there are discussions in the Department of Higher Education and Training as to how to merge, if there will be a need of merging certain sectors. Have you as a department, because of this issue always being raised time and again, to what extent have you engaged the Department of Higher Education and Training, in particular with the challenges that are experienced in the public sector? That's my point, because if then the department, my view would be that if the department is attending to this matter alone without taking the Department of Higher Education and Training on board, that would mean that you will have two different approaches in terms of scaling. Thank you, sir.
Honorable
Maluleke, Honorable Vegan, I can realize that you need to also add something. We'll do that immediately. Go.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to say, Biggie McNair, you can see there is progress on the department. If they can maybe add energy on their presentation, because if you can look at the problems that were raised there, they have also answers at the back. The meeting of public expectation, if you can see the challenges, conflict of interest, internals and irregularities. So the department has all the answers of doing, of improving on the issues that they have. So it's only to put pressure and energy on the issues that they raise. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Manila. Honorable Treya, and then I'll take Honorable Vikani. Sorry, I skipped your hand.
No problem, Madam Chair. It's fine. Yes, I want to take, come in with an angle completely opposite from what Madam Vikani has suggested. You know, the two major entities under the department is CETA and PALAMA, and both of them have been experiencing major problems over the last number of years. They're not really, hulle kom nie soos in Afrikaans, hulle kom nie die mas op nie. They just struggle, they don't manage, they don't get come right. Now, have you ever considered, you see, okay, and CETA, one of the main mission statement or one of the things that they wanted to achieve is to become the employer or the service provider of choice throughout the public service. But they're not achieving that. They're actually far away off that target. Small number of civil state departments that actually use their services. It shows us that they simply can't compete. They're not competitive with other organizations providing a similar kind of service. And shouldn't one actually just forget about CETA and say you outsource this and let organizations or businesses compete to provide this service to government departments? And then you set the standards, this is what you want, this is the level of standards, level of service you require, and like put out tenders and see who gives you the best, you know, the, offers you the best contract and go out to those and let the specialist in the area, let they provide that service to government. And forget about CETA, they're struggling and they're just a major problem. And the similar with PALAMA. We say we need our civil servants need certain kind of training. This is what we want. We can determine what we want them to cover. And of course, you cover the course, you cover the outcomes, you determine the outcomes, and you outsource it to universities and technicals across the country and ask them to provide courses. And you pay them, obviously, for that, but they run that service. They do that training for government. And forget about PALAMA, scrap PALAMA, the universities, the technicons, they are training institutions. They have the facility, they've got the capacity, that's their business, that's what they do. Let them provide that service to government as well. I just want to ask if you've ever considered that, if not, why not? Thank you.
Chair, Honorable Chair, it's a debate, and it's tempting me. It could be a hard debate, but very long. But point taken, I think. But I think the views might be different.
No, actually,
I won't go into
actually, before you even go to that, Honorable Vikan, I think what I'm noticing is that the main issues.
Yeah.
We're going to break down discussion per issue once Kenny reports back, gives answers. Because normally when it's just a long answer, it allows what you want to talk about. So what we're going to do, we'll actually like that he responds to an issue. If we want to talk about it, we'll then do that. Otherwise, we might not see what is it that we're actually saying at this point in time. Proceed with the last part.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I've just forgotten two main points that I think that it's key that we actually also bring them on board. The performance management systems in government generally. I'm getting difficulty in getting a grip as to whether we have standardized policies. And if from the point of the ministers where performance agreements are being signed, is this now smoothly flowing down to the most lowest level as it should? And if not, what is being done about standardizing these performance agreements for all public servants and also based on the fact that if we take into consideration a more of an integrated public service,
because then there would be once again a gap when we talk about issues of local governance. And I'm interested in knowing as to what are you doing to close those gaps. The other issue I think, Chair, that we very often leave behind beyond CETA is the information communication systems, technical systems. We're not really putting an oomph into it. I think it's not enough the fact that GovTech was there and it was a success and it ends there. We're still not doing enough in relation to things like e-parliament, e-government, you know, e-community. We keep on singing these songs and they only seem to end at GovTech. And beyond GovTech, there's no continuity or there's no development in what should be happening in as far as ICT is concerned. It's as if we could get a special strategic plan from DPSA of how best they could incorporate such a process to ensure that it becomes more effective. Thank you, Chair.
So, I think we will get a bite on this issue once I can respond. So you have to pause after every response, Mr. Govender, so that we can engage on the issues. There are quite a lot that are lumped together, and we don't want just to have post questions answered, but we want to actually see where are we in terms of your reporting and what we actually expect as a committee. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for those comments and questions as well. I think a number of them are clustered, and I'll try and deal with them in that manner. The first one is around public participation to Zong service centres, as well as government accessibility in the rural areas. Firstly, I mean, public participation, by saying it's part of outcome 12, but part B of outcome 12 and driven by the Minister for Arts and Culture doesn't mean DPSA does not participate. Because the approach in the outcomes-based approach is it's a partnership arrangement. And a number of these projects are going to be driven by different departments. If you look at outcome 12 and part A, output 3 deals with systems, and that is driven by National Treasury, but the agreement is signed by the Minister for Public Service and Administration. But the Minister for Finance is a delivery partner in that agreement. So although his department drives the DPSA, plays a central role in that work. So public participation is still a core responsibility of government. Government still takes it very seriously in terms of public participation, in terms of transparency, in terms of the MBZOs, and engaging with the community in terms of all of these aspects. So that work will still continue in different aspects. I need to also indicate as part of the public participation work and why we brought it under arts and culture is the issues I think the honourable members have raised themselves, is the issue around social cohesion, the need to recognise a national identity. We recognise the diversity within South Africa, but we also need to build a sense of national identity, and that's going to be largely the work that's going to be driven. To indicate that particular part, the part B of outcome 12, driven by arts and culture, but includes sports, it includes Department of Basic Education. Basic Education has quite a comprehensive program in terms of curriculum and trying to nurture the sense of national identity. So it's a range of partners that are involved in that process will ensure that we get a sense of commitment, a sense of belonging, a sense of respect, and also a sense of rights and responsibilities. We're saying as part of this process of public participation, it doesn't help us to always say we need people to participate without creating an opportunity for them to participate, and secondly, without telling them where should they participate, how should they participate, what are their rights, what are the responsibilities as part of that process. So there's quite an extensive piece of work that's being developed around outcome Part B of Outcome 12. So Madam Chair, just to indicate, it's not an area we've just delegated somewhere else. It's still part of the comprehensive work in terms of building the social cohesion, building this nation that we want to see. The second part linked to that...
we'll just have, if members want to reflect on that issue, but also the understanding that there is this cluster formation thing where the department also works as clusters and so on, so that will also be part of that. It makes the work easier. That is understandable quite clearly. And we can get the next issue thing. You know, there's a program of nation building is quite huge. You know, we
I think it's a mammoth task. It's not as easy as just being said. But, you know, when we say we're building a nation, you know, it's not easy to start saying now we're a nation. You know, we become a nation when we share many other things, boundaries, identity, whatever. There's so many things that go along with it. So it's an engagement. It's a thorough engagement, and therefore it can make sense, of course, if many aspects are put together, including the role of parliament into that nation building. Okay. Is there issues that members want to raise along this?
Yes. So I'd just like to make a comment. There's a concerning factor in this issue of this thing of clusters and groups and cabinet and what. My concern around that is the fact that we must be careful of a situation where we form these clusters, we form these groups, like you've mentioned in the case of now arts and culture and whatever. But at the end of the day, we don't get this coordinated information for us to be able to align ourselves in processes that develop from that. So we just need to be careful in that when these formations are formed, to rather try and have a consistent or continuous coordination of clusters that you know that we can incorporate ourselves into that grouping or grouping's work in terms of our oversight, because I get the feeling we're starting to have too many segmented clusters and we're moving away from the issue of trying to cut down on silos and coordinating cross-cutting work. That's something I'm just noting. Thanks, Chair.
Noble Williams.
Thanks, Chairperson. On this part, this outcome 12 and public participation, my concern is that although, DG, you said that the department is still heavily involved in public participation, the perception is going to be that the department is separating itself from the community, and this is a big mistake. And even if you say that that's not the case and that arts and culture are working with the department in order to facilitate public participation, I'd like to know what mechanisms you've got to prevent the whole department thinking, well, it's not our problem, really, public participation. Arts and culture are dealing with it. I'm talking about people on the ground, not here. I'm talking about people, you know, on the ground dealing with the community. You're going to say, well, it's not my problem. It's an arts and culture problem. Thank you.
No other hand?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm going to respond to the first question first. I mean, the way we structured ourselves, and I think it will respond to Honourable Bikani's comment as well, the delivery agreement, the responsibility for the delivery agreement is assigned to a minister, and in this case it's the Minister for Public Service and Administration as the lead, and is supported by the Department for Public Service and Administration and all of the other departments within the ministry. The second thing is we then report at what we call the GNA Cluster Committee, which is where all the DGs sit, provincial DGs as well as national DGs sit, all their representatives. That committee must report on a regular basis to the Governance and Administration.
Do you want to explain
GLA? Oh, Governance and Administration. The Governance and Administration Cluster Committee, which is the heads of departments. The Governance and Administration Cluster Committee reports to the Governance and Administration Cabinet Committee. So we need to report on a regular basis through that in a very coordinated, consolidated, and in a single manner. Yes, in this presentation today, I didn't focus on those other three outputs in relation to free and empowered citizens. But when we normally report to GNA, to Governance and Administration, we cover all seven. And I think in future, in all presentations as well, we should look at all seven to give a consolidated view as to what the work is happening in all of those areas. So to answer Honourable Williams' question as well, DPSA, through the Minister for Public Service and Administration, is responsible for outcome 12. I know I personally chair the Governance and Administration Cluster Committee, and we ensure that there's no way DPSA can abdicate. At the end of the day, we are held accountable. We need to ensure that the work is done. I hold on a regular basis meetings with the chairpersons or the conveners of all seven of those outputs. We've convened, each output is convened by a convener, and I meet with them regularly just to check progress, to check that there is alignment, the work is getting done. So I think in those means, DPSA cannot abdicate, we try and monitor it. In terms of getting it down, lower down is an area we still need to think about, because this is still at that level where you're looking at heads of department interaction. As in terms of cascading lower down is an area we need to think about, because the responsibility there is the investing with the individual department, be it basic education, be it local government, or be it sports or arts and culture. So it's an area I think we need to take on board.
Okay, should we proceed to the next issue?
Madam Chair, then the second issue is the Tusong Service Centre. I think it's linked to the issue of getting services to the rural areas. Tusong Service Centres, at the moment, there's still debate at government level as to the appropriate placement of Tusong Service Centres. At the moment, it's driven by GCIS, Government Communication Information Services. They're still responsible for the project. We work jointly with GCIS, DPSA, GCIS, and local government in terms of rolling out Tusong Service Centres. Madam Chair, we will be issuing an invitation very soon to the committee to attend the opening of the Tusong Service Centre in an urban mall, the Maponyo Mall. It's going to be the first Tusong Service Centre we're opening in an urban mall. I think it's going to be either January or late December. But we will be issuing that invitation to participate. Tusong Service Centres, in the way we define access to services, it's simply one of the means. It's not the only one. We're also looking at PITS, public information terminals, which we've established and put up in lots of post offices and so on. We're still using, to a large extent, the mobile units. Home Affairs is using mobile units. SAPS is using mobile units. So part of the work we're doing here as part of integrated service delivery is to say we need to get services to the rural areas. We need to determine the maximum distance an individual needs to travel before one can access a service, and that's the work we want to establish the norms. Whether it's 50 Ks, whether it's 30 Ks, or whether it's 10 Ks, it's an area we need to look at. We're also mindful of the resources. You can't say, okay, you need to have a service within 50 Ks. The question is, can you build a Home Affairs office, a police station, a school, and all of these things within? It's going to be quite challenging. So the idea is, how do we integrate those services to make sure it's provided on a regular basis? Whether we use school facilities where there are schools, whether we use clinics, hospitals, outside of those times or we extend. But those are various areas we're looking at in terms of accessibility to various services. So Tusong Service Centres, two aspects to it. One is we're trying to deal with internally in government, and I'm sure it will be clarified as part of this bill, as to what and where is it located, who is responsible for funding, who is responsible for its management, who is responsible for the appointment of staff, the optimal functioning of the unit, and secondly, it's going to play a greater role in terms of integrated services delivery going forward. And I think those are the two key issues around Tusong Service Centres.
Thank you, Chairperson. Listen, that's all well and fine, but while you're busy making up your mind where the Tusong Service Centres are going to go, the people on the ground are having serious problems accessing government services, and they're expecting your department to actually give them that assistance. So I'm a bit disappointed that Tusong Centres weren't in this presentation whatsoever. Again, you're like throwing this out the window with the public participation, and this is quite disturbing. Because we've actually been to Tusong Centres as a committee, and we've seen what the chaos is on the ground there. And is this going to go on for a long time? I mean, can you give us timelines when we can actually go to our community? Because my constituency has a Tusong Centre, and basically what it is a big empty room with a manager and stuff. But and the community expect there to be services there, and they do occasionally arrive. But we need to have some concrete stuff that we can say, this is an achievement of the state, or we're not going to do it anymore. But to confuse the community and say, we've got Tusong Centres, but we don't really know where who's in charge, but just hold on, you know, it just isn't good enough. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. DG, I understand that the Tusong Centres are just part of the government services to the public. When we were on these oversight visits to Tusong Centres last year, they told us that the goal was one Tusong Centre per municipality. Is that still the case?
Mr. Governor?
It's difficult for me, thank you, Madam Chair. It's difficult for me to give timelines, But I want to state quite clearly that, that this aspect in relation to, I want to also say before I make the point around final housing of Tusong Service Center, that in the interim, I know GCIS has completed an extensive research study into the functioning of Tusong Service Center. And yes, they've identified a range of problems, and I know they're currently putting mechanisms in place to address a number of them. And I think we need to look into those that are still failing us and put greater effort in making sure they turn around. The second thing, I know DPSA, and we've just signed a contract with CETA to start installing what we call LANs and WANs, the internet accessibility, to a number of Tusong service centers that have not had it. I think it's another 50 that we've signed a contract to continue with the installation. And in those cases, because there's no, in some cases, no electricity or telephone lines, we're using satellite feeds to get in services in the digital technology. So we are looking at improving some of them. We are looking at improving those that are underperforming. But I agree, it cannot be at the level at which it is. It needs to improve, and there needs to be a greater effort. And that's something we need to take seriously. I will make sure, if I'm still here, to do a presentation the next time around on Tusong Service Centers, is an area that we will focus on as well in terms of coming forward. The timelines, my sense, in terms of when it's going to be finalized will be determined by the legal framework that we will hopefully putting on the table very soon. I'm sorry, ma'am, I missed the second point.
Let's go.
The goal is one Tusong Center per year strategy.
Okay. I thought my memory was good. The initial idea was to ensure we have a municipality, every municipality being serviced with the Tusong service. And in some cases where we've identified bigger municipalities was to put more. In fact, the original thinking was to ensure every single ward has a Tusong service center. At the moment, I think it's sitting at just over 150-odd Tusong service centers. So our initial target is still one which says every single municipality should have one. And that's the work that's on track to ensure that. The sad part is that though we've got 150, and I know Honorable Member Williams is raising it, of the 150, I think there's only about 50% of them that are functioning at the level at which they should be. And we need to put more effort in making sure the others get on board and then start continuing the process. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us.
Honorable Dreyer? And Honorable Mahali.
On that point,
Honorable Maluleke.
On the point of the Tusong centers, Mr. Governor mentioned PITS, public information terminals. That kind of caught my mind. I'm not sure if I understand it correctly, but I imagine something like an ATM. You go there and you draw money, you go to this one, you make application for an ID, or you make application for whatever. And you put in your information, and it's all managed or handled electronically, and you come back later, and you will be issued with the relevant documents. Is it something like that? Can that not happen? I remember, you know, when the ATMs were initially introduced in our country, there were long queues. You had to wait because people, this was a strange phenomenon. People struggled to find their way around it. But as people became more familiar, they learned very quickly. It just goes quick, quick, and everybody goes there, they get their cash, or they make their transfers, and out you go, and the next one is in. And obviously that's the thing of the future. And instead of having physical Tusong centers and staffed by somebody from Home Affairs and somebody from SARS and somebody else from the welfare payments and so on and so forth, can't you just have these pits, as you call them? What are they?
Yeah, maybe before proceeding to Honorable... Okay, proceed, Honorable Mayule. Thank you, Chair. On the issue of taking services to the people, which the DG was referring to, maybe using schools or offices, we experience that because we are from rural areas where we don't have offices in Moretti. the challenge is that the departments, they don't have staff. You'll find maybe people arrive in the office at 4 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and they will only maybe assist it out of maybe 150 or 300. So that is a challenge. The government is trying the best, but we have shortage of staff, only staff, even on the tutoring centers. You'll only find home affairs, they have some days there, maybe they come on Wednesday, and the other days they don't come. They have their days, and when they come on Wednesday, they will assist maybe 15. Next time, the other 15. So it's still a challenge on the issue of staff.
Jenna, I was just going to the issue of the Tufan centers. Perhaps also as a committee, we need to have a look at in our next year's program in particular. I don't remember us, perhaps in my time, to calling GCIS to come and actually indicate to us their overall frame of work and exactly what they cover and what are the changes, because I also think that there's a lot of changes. I'm just thinking of this in light of what we are mentioning now, the Tusong Center, that we need to start getting direction. Now, the last time it was the Deputy Minister's, responsibility to ensure that Tucson Centers and CDWs are actually put into the right framework of mind, but it looks like it's slipping once again. If that could also then be handled as a priority, where we are able to get an understanding in terms of Tucson Centers, GCIS, CDWs, in a particular threat plan that can be presented to us, and perhaps restructuring of services within the Tucson Centers, because there's a lot of irregularities in the way they're operating presently, and there doesn't seem to be an improvement. And perhaps then, particularly with what Honorable Maluleke has just referred to, in line with staffing, that CDWs be considered as key to being coordinators of these Tucson Centers, but then we need to understand the alignment of these CDWs in terms of what department are they truly aligned to, and whether the Deputy Minister is still the person who's going to be responsible for that. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable, thank you, Chair. No, I wanted to make a suggestion, because my worry is that I can see the DG. I don't want him to tell us something that he will not remember tomorrow. Some of the comments that were raising and other issues which are not necessarily part of the presentation that he prepared himself to present. Because the issue of the Tucson service centers has been raised. My suggestion, Chair, would be that is it possible for the department to look at that and sometime early next year, in order, on the basis of the issues that have been raised, instead of him responding to the questions, responding to the problems that are experienced in the constituencies. So how about if we take that information and link with the other departments that are involved in the operation of the Tucson service centers, and then at least next year you give us some kind of a comprehensive presentation as to these are the status given the issues that I think it was raised more than once, that you might have a Tucson center only to find out there are no services that people, are getting out of that. Even if you have identified a school and look for a class to get office, you'll find a situation where there is no person who is manning that office then. So my suggestion is along those lines, Madam Chair, that rather than the DG trying to scratch his head and not find answers, can we give him that opportunity given the all the challenges that have been raised? Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with what you're proposing, Honorable Nyakema. The ACMC has been very frank and very honest that in terms of the Tucson centers, this is the center. So quite a lot haven't been actually dealt with in that area. And there's no point for us to discuss it for the sake of discussing. because what we are now intending to do as a committee is to stop the discussion in this sense of discussing for the sake of discussing. We will be moving to the core content of issues. You know, for an example, we know that there is involvement of these, like Honorable Zikani raised it. We don't really find it factoring quite well. So I think we can allow space on this one, but safe to indicate that as this committee, we did also take oversight visits on the two strong centers. We still have reports, we still have recommendations that we have made, but we haven't dealt up on this matter to the core. So what we want to do is to deal with it, because in this time around, we're not going to move away from an issue except if it's exhausted, we're satisfied. Tucson is one of them, and we're actually putting it on the agenda that since we also did work as a committee, there is a need for us to follow up and talk about it, project it even in terms of discussion, encourage other members. Now, for an example, I'll request the committee where we are located will be doing constituency work to visit the Tucson Saturday where we are working, so that we beef up the report we already have, that this is what we have also found in addition to the visit that was done jointly in a committee work. We also have individual committees that we have visited. We will also encourage Parliament to request members when they do this kind of work to visit those centers, because that's how we work as this committee. Our work cuts across that part of things, that so we need to sort of, after working on this area, put up a program where when members of Parliament, you know, in their individual structures, or even, yes, in their individual political organizations as well, you know, part of it, we try and bring an impact. You know, that oversight can't be done ad hoc, or just to some few. You know, we need an overhaul so that this thing functions. So long as they don't know, they know that somebody will come, they'll do something. If then it's quiet, it might not help. Safe to say, I appreciate that you're going to open the, you know, the Tucson Center at Maponya Mall. It's next to my home, you know. I never influence, there's no conflict of interest, it just shows on your own. I heard it from the meeting. I appreciate that. I will actually, because they, I can walk to the Maponya Mall from my home, you know. So thank you very much about that, but we need more. You know, everybody says, I appreciate, like me. Okay. Can we then move to the next issue, Mr. Govender, except if there's something we need to respond to, but surely I want us to take the line of saying we want to work on this area. We have flagged it as this committee. We are not on the side. Of course, I don't want us to start engaging, you know, something else government. You know, we want the government to be we want it to be there, to feel and touch government. So if you talk about everything, we think we can't have a touch and feel all the time. But you talk of a government that you can't see and feel. That is another debate. We can take it up at that level, but that's not what we want. We want a developmental state that is able to do an impact directly and so on. Okay. Can we then move to the next issue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will prepare a comprehensive presentation on Tucson Service Centers and CDWs, and we'll be looking forward to the invitation to present. We will also do that jointly with GCIS and COPTA. I think we need to come with our partners to do the presentation. Madam Chair, the next area that was raised was the issue around trade unions in relation to disciplinary processes and the time frame. I think that the Honourable Member is correct. The disciplinary processes in the public service in general is arrived at through a collective agreement. It's a collective agreement that stipulates the process as we manage discipline in the public service in general. I'm saying public service because teachers are different. Teachers are regulated by law. It's in the Employment of Educators Act. Asking police services in the police regulations. Correctional services are correctional services regulations determined in terms of the Act. So the general public service, it's the collective agreement that regulates it. The issue around trying to shorten the time frames, remember in the disciplinary processes itself, public servants are represented by either a fellow employee or a trade union representative. And in that process, I mean, it's both sides. I know trade union representatives that represent employees have been doing a fantastic job. And they also have been trying to fast-track a number of these hearings to conclude as soon as possible. But there's also the other side where you have trade union representatives who use every single tactic in the book to delay. So I think it works on both ways, and in the same principle with lawyers, legal advice that some of them engage. But I think at the end of the day, we need to acknowledge disciplinary processes is a management process, and the responsibility rests with government to ensure we get it done as soon as possible. And I think that's the area we need to start building the capacity to make sure management takes greater responsibility in the finalization of the disciplinary processes. So I don't think we can blame the unions or anyone else in terms of this particular process, but I want to acknowledge that there will be some areas that we want to change, and we will have to go back to the negotiation process to amend the resolution to try and fast-track some of these things. One area we failed in the past, we tried to introduce arbitration rather than going through the full disciplinary hearing, then find a person guilty, dismiss the individual then declares a dispute, and then you end up in conciliation, arbitration through counsel processes. We wanted to fast-track all of that and go to arbitration as part of the pre-dismissal. So we call it pre-dismissal arbitration. We've introduced that for senior managers. The only thing we put in there is that it's voluntary. Both parties must agree. So you avoid this lengthy disciplinary process and then a lengthy conciliation arbitration before getting an outcome. That seems to shorten the period in which we're getting it. Labor, unfortunately, didn't support us in that particular process when we went to council to amend that the agreement on that one. I think that was a straightforward issue.
Just to find out, you know, what we had this experience of a public sector strike, and to just find out from the department the thing in terms of avoiding that kind of situation moving forward. I'm sure those are the facts that we've already aligned within the department. But I think also maybe there were some clumsy ways that we got involved in terms of interaction on that bargaining process. And therefore, is there maybe improvement?
Madam Chair, you're absolutely correct. I mean, I think from government side, we acknowledge we cannot year in and year out go through that type of industrial action. It's both very, very disruptive to the public service. It has an impact on life. It has an impact on the running of the public service. It has an impact on relationship between management and employees. It has an impact on employees themselves in the working environment. So it's something that's definitely something we want to manage and move away from. I know we've conducted a range of assessments. After the 2007 industrial action, we went through an extensive engagement where we brought in outside people to do an assessment. We conducted a comprehensive perception survey. We conducted an independent assessment in terms of the way the employer handled the industrial action in 2007. It was Duncan Innes that we brought in to do the assessment. Based on the outcome of those assessments, we then revised our approach the following year. And it seems we'll have to go back to the drawing board, Madam Chair, and look at it again in terms of the 2010 industrial action. But that work is ongoing. We're busy doing analysis. I know the Minister has called for a number of reports in that regard. And it's something we need to manage in terms of the relationship between the employer and employee, and particularly trade unions in this regard. It's a difficult one for me to answer in terms, because being central to it, it would be, I think we need to do independent assessments and come and tell us, you got this wrong and that wrong. If I stand here and speak to it, I'm going to find excuses as to why we did certain things. We need an independent assessment to advise government in terms of how do we improve the manner in which we engage at the collective bargaining level.
Just to indicate that we do definitely, as a committee, also have an interest to see to the way forward, and therefore also demand that at some point we have an interaction with the department to just find out the plans moving forward that has that report you're talking about, which has a thorough assessment with me, right, to reflect on it.
and be clear in terms of our way forward, Honourable William.
Thanks, Chairperson. On this issue, I'd just like to know, what is the current relationship between the department and organised labour? And for instance, is it always like us and them? And is there any, you know, mechanism set up in order to bring you closer to one another? I mean, fundamentally, it shouldn't be like that. I mean, I understand there's wage negotiations and striking and et cetera, et cetera. But then after that's done and dusted, surely you can go back to a closer relationship, especially with regard to the anti-corruption drive. Because where corruption happens is where the union members are. And so they could report these things. And what is that relationship? Or is it very much like us and them? And the only time you see each other is across the barricades. Thank you.
I think I was going to ask a similar question to Honourable Williams, but now I'm going to relate it to the actual relationship in terms of labour relations within the sub-directorates of human resource management. I think there's also a need for more transparency on processes there. At some stage, there was a report from the Public Service Commission, I think, on the state of labour relations within the public sector and the status as to how far are they in terms of unsolved or unresolved cases within the public service sector. At some stage, you might have to pull that out as well to understand the seriousness of the problem, because it's fairly hidden.
Mr. Govender?
Ma'am, simple response to the relationship. I think between the employer and the trade unions, we have an excellent relationship, during the strike and after the strike. The minister has invited senior leadership within the trade union movement to participate in a range of activities, including the APRM activity and so on. So we do meet labor on a regular basis, so they do participate. Interestingly enough, many of the unions still invite me personally to participate in a number of their conferences, presentations. They've invited, quite a few of them invited me for lunch and supper towards the end of the year as well. So we do have a very good working relationship at all levels in terms of engaging. It's just during that strike and the participation at different levels. And even during that period, you can still call up individuals and still have a very concrete discussion on a range of issues. So I think the relationship is still there. There's definitely not an issue. The state of labor relations in departments is a serious concern. That was highlighted in the 2007 perception survey, came out very clearly in that perception survey. And in all of our research as well, we've identified labor relations, management and their role and responsibility in terms of managing staff and managing discipline. That was the main reason why we developed the module on labor relations training for managers in the public service. And Palama will be responsible in rolling that out. There are a great deal of unsolved cases at departmental level. We haven't done an analysis, but based on the information we receive at regular intervals, it's an area we need to focus on. That's definitely a concern.
Just to conclude by saying, around the issues of the bargaining council, the bargaining processes, and the department, we will work with the Labour Committee to actually engage on that aspect thoroughly until we acquire that you are satisfied that you might not have some breakdowns unnecessarily in the future. Well, we consider that you are also doing those reports and we need a fully fledged interaction at that level. Okay, we can move to the next issue.
Madam Chair, I think the second one was the next issue was a straightforward one. Yes, we will provide regular reports once the unit is up and running as to how we make an impact in terms of corruption and fighting corruption in the public service. We will try and manage that. The role of PCETA going forward, and I think that issue is linked up. There's quite a few questions around PCETA and training in general. And whether I'm of the view, and I need to just check this, Madam Chair, I'm not 100% sure, but I thought Parliament was one of the entities that was linked to the PCETA. Because remember, PCETA includes departments that are not departments or any other sector-specific CETA, and there's a range of entities. And the way the definition stands in the PCETA constitution, it simply says all entities that are not assigned to any other CETA end up in the PCETA. So my understanding was Parliament was part of PCETA. But I need to just that when I did that constitution at that point, I remember those the wording at that stage. So I think yes, DPSA has a role to play in getting PCs up and running, and we do play that role. But we need to also acknowledge, and I think that's the presentations we had earlier this year jointly with the higher education and ourselves, the main responsibility for the effective and efficient functioning of PCs rests with the Department of Higher Education. The minister of the executing authority responsible for the CETA is the Minister for Higher Education and Training, not the Minister for Public Service and Administration. DPSA and the Minister for Public Service and Administration provides more a supporting role in the sense that their funds come through DPSA and we provide them with financial as well as corporate services functions in terms of dealing with all their procurement, in terms of paying their HR, all of those things we do. They're currently in the process of setting up their own systems. So come 1 April next year, PCETA, in my view, should be totally independent, and the indications are they will be with their own HR, with their own financial, and the only thing they will get through DPSA is quarterly drawdowns in terms of the budget that comes through DPSA. In fact, recently they've completed their budget for the next MTF process, and as DPSA, as part of the MTF engagement, we've been engaging with National Treasury to support them with funds, to make sure that they have adequate funds over the next 3 years to better deliver. And I think with the appointment of the new CFO, the appointment of the new CEO, with the administrator, Temba, that's there, it's making a huge difference in reestablishing PCETA going forward. And remember, the Minister for Public Service, the Minister for Higher Education has taken a decision to only extend their accreditation for 1 year. He wants to be sure that they are in a position to do the work. And I think between higher education and DPSA, and as well as Palama, we will have to play a central role in making sure PCETA gets off the ground and delivers. Just the final point on PCETA, Madam Chair, is to indicate that committee, remember the presentation from the DG Higher Education, a joint committee, National Treasury, DPSA, has been established. It's in place. I think their first meeting is, one of the meetings on the 21st of November as well, to support them in all of the areas. They've established three subcommittees looking at operational issues, looking at governance issues, and looking at the constitutional issues as well. They want to change their constitution. So work is on track to get the CETA up and running.
That's on the issue that you raised at first. I think, yes, there was that ongoing way that the PCETA was engulfing Parliament as well. But I don't think it really did work well. Maybe part of it is because of the paralyzed status of CETA with this program, so it never entered well. And again, if you just look at it, because there is a such a called salsa, there is a consistent discussion and a realization that, you know, Parliament as legislators are separately designed than government, and that collapse, of course, was not informed if we look at it. So that discussion is ongoing, and therefore, perhaps there would be something that looks into the sector of legislatures as legislatures. But yes, of course, there was that, but it doesn't make sense. And it was even made not to even work by the paralyzed status of the PCTA itself as well. But nonetheless, there is a growing discussion, and it makes sense that they can't be collapsed today because PCTA, to get, you know, when you look at it in relation with Parliament, yes, for public service. Parliament deals with representatives, representing people, taking Parliament to people where people can talk. It's programmatic. That's where the service delivery is actually implemented from Parliament. So I think it's an ongoing discussion, but you're right that it was located there at some point. So that's, it grows from that point. Therefore, it's one area. Those are some of the areas that we need to engage going forward with. I know this is a structure called Southside coming up with a package for the legislature.
Also, Chair, this brings to mind I think there's also a human resource development or HRD council or something like that. That council, I mean, we need to understand more what role does it play, I think, in us to be able to coordinate relevant information, because I think it's been read by the Deputy President, if I'm not mistaken. But it also goes back to the issue of concern of the PCTA being partially an entity of DPSA, and what role are they playing in the corrective measures, for that matter, of it being under administration presently? One would be interested in knowing what that program is that they are running. Whoever the stakeholders are that are involved there, is DBSA part of this? I'm just saying, yeah. We need to know more about that. I think it's also a bit of vague information as far as how best are they assisting processes and ensuring that the PCTA gets back on its feet in a quicker manner.
Okay, in the PCTA environment in relation to the Department of Higher Education and Minister of Higher, you have a number of stakeholders. The overall executing authority is the Minister for Higher Education and Training. He has an advisory body that advises him on CETA, even on the recertification of, or reaccreditation of CETA, and that's the NSA, the National Skills Authority, which advises on whether they should be recertified or not. Then you have a further advisory body, which is basically the old GIPSA, and that GIPSA has now been collapsed into what we call the HR Council, or the HRT Council. The old GIPSA. The representation on that particular body includes business, government, and labor in that body. It's chaired by the deputy president, and it's under the auspices of the Department of Higher Education and Training. So that would be the ideal department that we need to bring here to account in relation to that particular body. It advises on the human resource strategy for the nation as a whole.
Remember, do you want a 10-minute tea break and then we'll come back to finalize the other issues?
Sure.
10-minute break?
Because I need minutes of the details.
I don't want to discuss the details.
Yeah. This is old, yeah. Because he used to be, in the department, the Portfolio Committee on Labour. He's originally from Lumsa.
They probably didn't update it yet.
Yeah, it hasn't been updated.
It's that empty with the branches on it.
Yeah. Anyway.
I want to go.
I'm going to give you, write in my email address.
Oh, okay. What is it for the...
Anything. For the vacancy, you can send me the minutes of this meeting?
I can't send it directly to you.
Oh, okay.
You can give it to the website.
Oh, okay.
Because I can.
Okay.
Yeah. Once I've compiled the report, it goes to the website.
Okay.
And then they put it on the system.
Okay.
The website. See, anybody can.
Yes, okay, but you can send me the unedited one, the one that's not edited. That you did before they took out thing.
It's going to be the same because I'm dangerous.
I mean, you can send me an email and then when the adverts are re-advertised, anyway, whatever.
The 10 minutes back.
She used to work for summer before. Now she's working for Soweto.
I'm going to
go. No.
And you're still coming to it,
then? Really? Yes, Anna. Anna Weeks, but now she's, yeah. Used to be Anna Weeks, but she married her. No, she's employed.
That means that by the freelancers very well.
Okay.
I'd rather be a freelancer.
Yeah, but talk to her and maybe...
Okay, somebody that
okay.
I know from you. It's often to actually come in long time ago.
Mm.
Because I need it.
You don't like it? Oh. No money. Can't be anything. So give me your email address.
Oh, my.
Let me get my email.
Driving that project to also have the funds so that we can manage it better.
because every little thing you do, you're going to need National Treasury permission to do it, and we requested that fund. But the strategy, the operational plan, the overall responsibility for the project is at National Treasury level. There's a DDG that's appointed to drive it by the name of Mr. Kun Kruger, who's driving the project. So when we do the presentation on IFMS, we will be coming, as I indicated in the last meeting, with the National Treasury, CETA as the primary systems integrator, as well as DPSA. And it has about six different legs, the IFMS project. One of them is the HR module to deal with all the HR practices. And the HR module itself has something like 11 various fields that it's looking at: recruitment, appointment, exit, performance management. There's a whole range: labor relations, career pathing, planning, HR planning. So there's a whole range of separate modules within the HR module itself. What is the relationship between IFMS and PASAL system? Remember, the PASAL system is a personnel salary payment system. That's what it was designed to do. That's what it does, and it does a very good job in paying salaries. The IFMS, one of the legs in the IFMS system, is going to deal with a payroll system. It's going to come up with a payroll solution, and we are busy designing that payroll solution as well. Once the IFMS is fully functioning, the payroll solution is fully functioning within the IFMS, the PASAL system will fall away. It's what we call the legacy systems. PASAL, BAS, LOGUS, all of those legacy systems will fall away once the IFMS is fully functioning, and it integrates all of these aspects. The reason why, as government, we took a decision not to upgrade PASAL in any way is because it's going to be double expenditure. You're going to spend money upgrading PASAL system when you're going to retire the system very soon. So therefore, we said, let's clean up. So we're not improving the system in any way. We're not doing any enhancements or modifications or customizations on the PASAL system. The only thing we're doing as part of the PASAL exercise is PASAL cleanup. We're cleaning up the quality of information that's currently on PASAL. So even when we migrate that information from PASAL to IFMS, we'll be able to migrate clean information, corrected information into the new system. So that's the cleanup exercise we're doing in the PASAL system. Madam Chair, I agree. The issues that we need to also deal with is around e-government, ICT policy. I'm sure members are aware of the work we're doing around e-government in terms of the pro-poor services and trying to create a platform for that. It was announced by Minister Geraldine, ex-Minister Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi at one stage. It's work that's delayed. I mean, it's taken us very long to get it off the ground. It should have been done earlier. Another project that has been delayed for a long, long time is Cabinet, which is now slowly taking off. And all of this work is being done under the auspices of CETA, S-I-T-A. I'm not sure if I'm going to stop at that point.
Honourable
William
and Honourable
Vigan. Thank you, Chairperson. We had a meeting about this cleanup of the cell before, and is the cost still going to cost 50 million rand, or have you looked at that? Because that's what we were told last time, you were going to train people to put in the right data so that it would clean up the system. And although you keep saying that we're not going to upgrade it, this is still a lot of money to spend on the system that you're then going to clean up and then get rid of. And is that figure still around 50 million rand, or do you have information that it got less, or what, or what's happening? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. This IFMS thing and its relationship to CETA, something is not hitting me well. Yes, the finances have to come from National Treasury anyway, but the key role player to this, and also to ensure that we are keeping up to the word of saying that we are eventually giving an effective, efficient, integrated system, would actually be the prerogative of the CETA. So I still fail to understand as to, I don't know if I should say DPSA should perhaps have some sort of stringent measure to, I don't want to say use the word supervise, but they need to put pressure on CETA to start taking an initiative in this and becoming the lead role player, because then how is a government entity, information systems entity, showing or proving itself to be becoming effective if they're not going to lead this process? Yes, the money is going to come from National Treasury. Even if National Treasury
wasn't going to be a key role player in the message. Wouldn't have made a difference more than it's important, because we're talking of systems that have to be put into place, and technical systems are mainly lying within Zeta. So I still don't see Zeta playing, taking up enough responsibility and leading enough as people who are actually the ones who are actually placing these systems. And Chair, can we have these editions of this book, please? We don't. This is an e-government book, and it's got the PSA there. Yeah, it's charging at 99 rand. We'll buy it if we have to. But I think this would be essential for us to actually start coming on board on issues of ICT in government, particularly. And they mustn't be so selfish and keep it to themselves. I don't even know how many times this edition comes out, but this one that I'm holding is already the sixth edition of 2010.
Okay, just to indicate again, Mr. Kavanda, before you respond, that if we follow through what came before the committee, particularly what was released last week by the Auditor General in terms of the IT system, particularly from our side, there's a huge fault, that's not a small matter. Because if the whole technology within government is paralyzed, then it means we have a non-functional public sector and administration. So it's a serious matter of concern. I'm sure even following it up in this manner is still minor, because that issue is very serious for us. But this committee would need to concretely go to identify issue by issue as raised by the Auditor General, because it's really scary. That was the outcome as per the Auditor General. And therefore, when we were making an output in terms of, what went wrong, I can't get, there's no response actually things went wrong and this is where it went wrong. Because if there was any stagnation, as the department, you definitely have to deal with it. If, say, for instance, somebody was responsible or the whole, we need to, that must come before us, and definitely it's a major area of concern for the committee. So we don't want to deal in these things. They're all linked together. And as a matter of principle, if you deal with the outcome, that outcome needs to also talk to what went wrong. Because now, I know that it's captured within the overall outcome of the Auditor General, and it's going to be there. In fact, the road shows. They'll be talking about those matters. And, of course, as this committee, it will be, didn't we capture that there was such a big problem? And therefore, that issue is much a bigger issue and would really need a thorough response from the department on that one. What went wrong? Why? How are we going to amend it? Because even the money, when we looked at when we were dealing with the BRRR, there was no expenditure along that side. A lot of money haven't been spent along that. So for us, it's a link. They are not different entities. There are issues that go together, and we think the department owes us a serious explanation on that one before it actually is going to be a song that will be sung out there, because now the audit is out there publicized. When they were indicating issue by issue, it was scary. So I think also, let's not treat it like ad hoc, but treat it with an understanding that there's a huge fault on that area, and with an understanding what is the department going to do with such a discrepancy.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think we note those comments. The Auditor General also wrote DPSA a letter after concluding the audit process, raising the issues around ICT. We've immediately took steps as DPSA and included, I think it was six policy issues he raised, the absence of national policy on a range of issues. We've now included all of those areas in the work plan of the Deputy Director General responsible for that area, and work has commenced, as I indicated, as part of my report in the previous meeting. But we need to pay closer attention to a number of those policies, because if those policies are not in place, it has the impact of having a huge financial fallout at the end of the day, and it's something we need to think about. The 50 million rand in terms of the personnel cleanup was the projected budget at that stage. I think that 50 million rand is still standing as a projected budget. I'm not sure we're going to spend all of that 50 million rand, because we're working with departments to ensure that the responsibility of cleanup is their responsibility, and they should be funding a large chunk of that. So GPSA is not putting up the 50 million rand, let me put it that way, to fund the Pasar cleanup. It's the overall cost to do that cleanup. The cost in terms of spending that money in terms of cleaning up the Pasar system has the downstream advantage of ensuring we have clean information for transferring to IFMS. The challenge we're sitting with is if you transfer corrupt data, then you're starting off with an incorrect base as well. So we may have to spend, whether we spend it through the Pasar cleanup or we spend it through the data migration process as part of the IFMS, we'll have to spend that money somewhere along the line to make sure it's quality information that we move across. Madam Chair and Honourable Bikani, the issue around CETA is central. The entire IFMS project is driven together with CETA. CETA is central. They provide all of the expertise in the development of the system. They provide expertise in terms of the architecture of the systems we design. They provide expertise in terms of the training, the development, the testing rooms, everything in relation to IFMS. This project is going to go nowhere without the centrality of CETA, because we're also very mindful of the system and very mindful of the fact that once the IFMS is put in place and the various modules are put in place, the maintenance of that system is going to be the responsibility of CETA. So part of the exercise is skills transfer, the training, the upscaling, the upskilling, and the increased staffing at the level of CETA to make sure the systems continue functioning. So CETA is central. There's absolutely no doubt about it. We've had challenges with them in terms of ensuring they have the right people in place at the right time so that we can get things moving. And that fight is ongoing between us, the DPSA, National Treasury, and CETA. But we work jointly with them to make sure they have the skills in place to get the job done. So, CETA is central. In fact, if you look at the procurement processes we followed for the HR module, it was done under the auspices of CETA. So CETA procurement processes were followed. CETA procurement processes were followed now in the procurement of the procurement module itself, for the HR module itself. Even for the skills to now develop the payroll solution is driven by CETA themselves. So we're doing it as an in-house development. So they'll be able to manage and maintain the system going down the line. So I just want to make the point that CETA is central to the IFMS project. There's no ambiguity in that regard.
Next, Jefferson, the point I just want to make is that although DPSA is not putting up the 50 million rand, the taxpayer is in fact putting up the 50 million rand. And we must bear this in mind, because it is a bit suspect that we've got two systems, and we discussed this at the last meeting, and it seems you're just going to go ahead anyway, that you're going to update an old system and then put that old updated system onto the new system instead of just updating the new system. So please try to keep within the 50 million, because if it goes over, well, we'll be hearing from me.
Then it means that I think it should also be an area of priority for us in terms of oversight. Unfortunately, it looks like we're going to have to go back and it again at CETA, because it's not really, I'm still maintaining that departments, provinces, provincial departments with national, they're still very fragmented, very, very fragmented, and there's still a high rate of departments, especially in provinces, that hardly mention even the CETA, the way they use services elsewhere, rather than the department. So if this IFMS system is meant to be a success and it's meant to integrate the work that's going to improve public service delivery in terms of their systems, then I still think that we'll have to get a more detailed brief from CETA and an indication, because even on their strategic plan that they presented to us the last time, yes, IFMS was one of the issues, but mentioned on a very small scale. So we'll need to get more information the next time they come in terms of how in charge are they of all these systems being integrated into departments, being integrated into provinces, and we need to determine the effectiveness of their work.
Including the fact that when we're talking about the vacancy rate, that average of 19% is based from PESA.
Ma'am, I'm going to look into that book. It's the first time I'm looking at the book as well. The Effective E-Government. The next issue that was raised, I think it's more around training and the centrality of Palama. And just to indicate, as per my presentation as well, Palama, the minister has taken direct responsibility for ensuring there's a turnaround strategy in Palama itself. To ensure that Palama and all training in the public service goes to Palama, and I think it's linked to the question Honourable Dre has raised as well, in relation to why use Palama when we can go out and find training ourselves. The model that we use at the moment, there's a very small percentage of the training that is provided in government that is provided by government. Lots of the training is provided by outsourced functionaries. Private training providers, FET colleges, universities, lots of departments have relationships with them that provide the training. The purpose of having Palama then, and it's very similar to the German model at the moment, where the idea is to ensure that Palama does the quality control, ensures a degree of uniformity, ensures that the elements that we want to be built into the training is built in. So it's making sure that that quality control is always there at all stages. If we allow departments to go ahead and procure services across the board without that checks and balances in place, we may not end up with the training of the quality we want or the outcome we want at the end of the day. So I think it's still a debate. I think the minister is of the view, and that's something we're working towards as well, is using Palama to try and present more of the training themselves. And that's the direction we're moving into. Through Palama and through the provincial academies, for us as government to accredit our own training and deliver our own training so that we can ensure the quality and the manner and the methodology is what we want to see in government. And that's the work that's ongoing in that regard. The final issue that was raised...
we take the explanation, but of course we should note that maybe it might come as a point of debate on that one. But I'm not sure if what we want to say is that, you know, what's our intention when we're talking to Palam, we realize that there's 80%, 70% outsourcing, which we thought it should be a turnaround. It was the other way around. Moving towards 100% involvement, well, we can't privatize training. Of course, you might not have the same opinion, but you can privatize training of government. In fact, you can have a shadow government, because it won't be us running the training, other people in their own opinion, the way they see how they want the training to happen. And therefore, to some of us, definitely, that can be a very hot debate in terms of if we want the government to outsource out training just like that. You know, it's a big problem for us. We actually were looking into turning around. We know that things are not as we expect in Palama, but we were looking forward to have Palama being entrenched as an institution that government can actually look into. But it does really, we can't accept the situation where everything is sourced out. You know, we source out everything else, and then we have people, you know, but those people who are trainers, they all have different opinions. They all do their training in their own ways, and they train from various institutions. Some of them might even bring, you know, some practices from other countries which might not be relevant for this country, and therefore it's an issue. I think we should project this matter at some point for another debate when we discuss about the issue of visas, because surely this outsourcing, sometimes it does pain us when we remain with a government which is not a government, which is someone else sourced out, which is a problem, of course. But nonetheless, let's put it that it's an issue that has been projected. We will engage with it. We will actually try to ensure that we have government at some point, not a service provider running government. Can we then proceed to the next issue, unless if members want to raise something on the matter?
What I was just going to add, Chair, in terms of the needs assessment also, the training that's being done in the public service is not needs-based. It's more like the Chair is saying sort of rushing for the money. As a result, we are missing the point. But I think also there needs to come a point where DPSA actually, or Palama then, I don't know, but then we need to come, as government, need to come to a point where the model, the workplace skills plan model, is a very good model. But for some reason or the other, it's not being adhered to. As a result, you get this issue of the problems we're facing with the CTAs of money being wasted because there's no accounting structure. Yes, the quality assurance and these other structures are there, but to particularly have a way of accounting for the monies that are being used, for the workplace skills plan that have to be submitted, there's a gap there. And that needs to be enforced. I don't know if it come from the DPSA side or from Palama side, but something needs to be done to even go the route of perhaps reviewing legislation. The Skills Development Act, perhaps, having a look at the Skills Development Act to determine as to how stringent are they in departments keeping up with the needs in terms of a workplace skills plan, including the audit assessment needs in departments. Because I think if we can start closing that gap also, it will also assist the processes of the PCTA adhering to what they're supposed to do. Thank you.
Okay, proceed, Mr. Govinda.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the last point is a very relevant one, and that's the one we're looking at in terms of the alignment of the training needs, the training provision, who provides it, how is it accredited, what does the requirement mean in relation to promotion in the public service, all of those issues. I think that's the critical issue, and it is part of the work plan going forward. It's also linked to the 1% training budgets in the department. So you try and link all of them to ensure that you spend money in the areas that you require the people to work. So that work is definitely there. Madam Chair, the last area that was raised, I think, just very briefly, the performance management system in government. Yes, we've informed departments about the alignment. We've been working with some departments to ensure alignments between the delivery agreement processes, the agreement signed by the minister with the president, and the alignment of that with the performance agreements throughout the organization. I can assure you in DPSA we've done that work as a department, and in the many of the other departments we've engaged with and supported, they've been unraveling that. My sense is it'll seriously take hold only from next year. This year it's still fragmented because the outcomes-based approach, as we knew, it just came into effect. There's been an alignment at the level of DG and the minister's agreement. But going lower down, we still see a disjuncture between that. And I think it's still new, and we're supporting departments to get that right. Hopefully it'll find better realization during the course of next year. Yes, there is a gap between what we're doing at this level versus local government, except to say that local government, as part of the delivery agreement 9, I think it is, which is the one that deals with local government, all municipalities and municipal managers and so on are part of that delivery agreement that brings them on board as well. So there is an element of alignment in terms of the responsibilities, but in terms of that alignment cascading into physical performance agreements that translates into actual assessment is an area I can't answer at this stage. We've not done any assessment or alignment in that regard. Thanks.
Honourable Member, is there anything on the responses that you still want to follow up on? Have you done?
Okay, it's just, for me, it's more on the overall progress report. That I think it was a good initiative that was very straightforward in terms of where we are going to with the public service. Mm-hmm. Out of this, we're even able to see the gap in terms of areas like that, like we make an example, like the Tusang Center. So I don't know if within what is in this report, if it's relevant that perhaps on a quarterly basis or whatever, we recheck again each of these issues that we've gone through now. I think it's an exercise that could cut a lot of us doing sideline issues that are not necessarily relevant, but also to assist us in prioritizing the issues of public service and administration, that this becomes a more detailed report in future, and as we go along, we must see the levels of progress in the form of a graph that we started off with this, present report of the 23rd of November, and the next quarter when you bring such a similar report, we must see the movement of improvement or way forward for us to stop feeling as though we repeatedly asking the same questions and nothing is happening. It will also give us, as a committee, I think, a sense of us being effective in the oversight work that we're supposed to be doing, and more direct when we go out to do our oversight work elsewhere, that we are proof of the effective, efficient public service delivery that we are seeing. Thanks, Chair.
Oh, I see. It's a long time. Okay, I think it sums it up, Honourable Members, you know, because it actually also assisted us to identify where we need to focus more. You know, it helps us in terms of moving forward on areas where we've identified gaps, where we actually have to emphasize, you know, because there's quite a number of areas that we haven't dealt to the depth, and therefore this helps us want to move next year to our strategic plan, to the areas that we need them to actually implement in terms of our oversight. Okay, I think now in the remaining time, we will allow. Pardon? Oh, you have. Yes, we're actually moving to that, Honourable Dreyer. Yeah, take the last slide, Mr. Governor.
As indicated in terms of the background, very briefly, the bill itself was withdrawn from the parliamentary processes in October of 2009 to allow for further consultation and further engagement at government level. That work has been ongoing for the past year and a half, 2 years. In our view, in terms of the process going forward, this presentation I'm doing here today is not going to look at any of the substantive issues around the bill, but simply the process to when do we get back and where do we go to from here. That process that we're currently engaging within government will be completed by January 2011, and we will have immediately thereafter, in February of 2011, we'll publish a draft bill for consultation. And that will be the broader consultation, which will include Labour, NEDLAC, all of those processes that we need to go through. During the period February to April 2011 will be that consultative process. Remember, we're talking about integrated public service. We're talking about a relationship between national, provincial, and local government. So the consultation will have to include the three spheres of government as well as all of the unions involved in this process. Once that consultation process is over in April, we'll then build in all of the comments we received through that process, revise the bill, and then take it back to the pre-cabinet certification by the state law advisors during April of 2011. We believe that during the period May-June 2011, we'll seek cabinet approval for the introduction of the bill in Parliament. And remember, before it's tabled in Parliament, there is also that certification process by the state law advisors, and our view is that by July 2011, we should be introducing the bill in Parliament itself for the parliamentary process. Thank you very much.
Okay, just to indicate, in the meeting, we're also joined by the principal state law advisor, who worked even in the previous public service management bill. She's Ms. Williams, and she's from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, who's at the back there, just as an initiative to also understand how far are we moving as a committee. Okay, I think that was just an outline of what we're
going to do. And as women, Chairperson.
Pardon?
And as women.
And as?
A woman. It's a woman.
That's an it. Okay. Yes, and as a woman, yes, as an addition, yes, so that you concretize that also women can do the loan. It's not a particular area that's assigned for only men. Okay. So, Honourable Members, that was an outline. And Honourable Dreyer, you want to engage on the process?
Yes, Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair, just for our own clarity and just to confirm, when there's, in this process set out to us, there's consultation with stakeholders. That's more internal. That's the labor unions and the three spheres of government. And I just want to make 100% sure, and the last bullet point, introduction parliament, that will then, well, it's submitted to the speaker, he will then refer it to this committee and possibly also local government, COPTA committee, Then we, as committees, invite the public and NGOs or civil society to make presentations, and that's when the process of hearings on the bill starts. So there's further consultation, but first it's internal consultation, and then we go outside to the broader public. Is that 100% correct, my understanding? That's, I just want to make sure.
Definitely. I think, yes. We are going to undergo the normal procedure of introduction of a bill without any shortcuts. Yes, I agree with that.
And just to clarify, Madam Chair,
yes.
Is there any other bill that you would like?
I think there is no other issue on this one, because that's a procedure to know a Solomon plan, where is it, what is going to happen, and how far are we. And then in terms of the nitty-gritties, we will still call the minister, maybe too, but we will. Our area of interest, like Honorable Gray is indicating, is when it's with us, so that we then have that process, normal process of you know, the hearings, etc. So we appreciate that input, but you'll keep informing us if there are further developments or if it's fast-tracked, we'll hear from you. Yeah, Honorable Members, I think now we've reached the end of the meeting. There's an issue, there's a matter that can be
raised. Yeah, just for us as a committee, internal matter, not for, outside or for the presentation. I just see that in our first term for next year, one of the things is nominations for the National Public Service Commissioners. And I know that the present chairperson, Dr. Kajima, his term expires, isn't it now at the end of this year? Or when exactly? It's very soon.
Yeah.
When?
Late January.
January.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I was just concerned about the timeline. His term expires in January. We really only start in February in Parliament. Then he's already left his post. And then we start the process. So I want to know, is there a way of speeding it up for example, nominations? It has to be printed in all the newspapers. Is that already gone out? So that when we come back, we're kind of ready to start the interview straight away. I'm just concerned that we don't want to have a period where that position is vacant or we have somebody acting.
Okay, you know, there's one matter that we just need to clarify, you know, because that's an area that concerns the committee, yes. But we need to, just if it can be clear to us that Dr. Nkidzima, you know how the Chapter 10 is. We do appoint 5 commissioners. We were part of the 2 last ones as this committee, you know, and we think I still believe that we did a good job because we're actually looking at what we're supposed to get. Yeah, we should. So, among those 5, Dr. Nkidzima is not part of them. Dr. Nkidzima is a provincial commissioner, and as a provincial, it is not within us, you know. As the term is lasting there in the province, they just made him a chairperson, you know, for the public union. But he wasn't appointed by us. He has to get nothing to do. It's a provincial process, that's why. The area that we concern ourselves is a national process, which we have to make sure that we are still constitutional. So it doesn't really affect us badly. It does go to an extent of there's a lack of a chairperson for the Public Service Commission, but it doesn't. It's not our. If his term lapses, it's the provincial term. It's not our. It's not ours. What we are concerned with, Honourable Dreyer, is the beefing up. On you know, we've got one of our best candidates passed away. We have to beef up that area up. Jane Mazumela, the one that you interviewed among the 2. She passed away, so there's a gap created. You know, one of the good candidates worked so hard to pick up from that interview. And we also had another one resigning. Those are the only areas that concern us, but not the issue of Dr. Nkidzima, because that's the provincial competence. But he was chair here, then we'll work it around that. So it doesn't really create a crisis for us, but it does. We do have a job to do to beef up those that are you know, that those 2 areas. But further than that, you know, the process is well taken care of.
you know, what we're working together with the minister and the president in terms of making sure the constitutionality, was this committee who can fall out of constitution, this committee will be found at fault. But nonetheless, we think everything is going on well. We are going to proceed with the interviews that you're talking about, of those that are within our scope of area.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. I'm glad that you gave us that information that's useful. I wasn't aware of the passing away of Matsumela. I didn't know that. And also the vacancy then of another one by a resignation. So we've got to fill that from national level. Okay, so we'll do that when in the new year. But then with the chairman, I also didn't realize that he was a provincial appointment. So I'm glad that I know that now. Thanks for that. But so it's that province where he comes from that will have to nominate and a new one to represent the province, that province on the Public Service Commission. Just for interest sake, which province? Gauteng. Okay. But so they're aware of it and they know that they have to make a new appointment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
In terms of that, but definitely we do have to advertise, have fill the gaps that are there on our side. Okay, you want to say something on the matter?
Members, essentially, we're just waiting for the letter from the presidency, and if we get that letter from the presidency, we can put an advert before the chairperson. We can run an advert during the holiday period, and then at the beginning of the year in the strategic planning workshop, we could follow the same process whereby subcommittees are appointed and they can run with that so that those two vacancies are filled as soon as the National Assembly is able to sit and Parliament is officially opened. Thank you.
So that's just to outline how far the process to also give confidence in the committee is well taken care of. Okay. Honourable members, we really want to appreciate that you have reached this last meeting of the year, whereby maybe some other things might crop up, but we think we have really tried our best in terms of dealing with this, with an understanding that there is so much that we haven't done, that we're supposed to do as a committee, and want to believe that this time around, I would really urge that we plan our strategic planning on time and make sure that all members are there, because that's where we actually do a decision in terms of moving forward. I think we're better informed. We now have a better understanding what is it that you want to do based on all the processes. And we're going to definitely sink down into those issues that we think we didn't clean them thoroughly because we've been touching and moving. We know what is it that you want to do in depth. And therefore, can we assist one another when we go to the strategic planning session to concretize that we can have discussion even prior where we get documentation, but we've got a better understanding and a clear understanding what is it that when we do it thoroughly, it might impact and progress within the public safety administration. And therefore, I'm looking forward to all of us attending the anti-corruption unit because it's part of the program that we want to expand and we'll be looking into. And therefore, it will be important for me to know who will not make it. I only got one apology from the member that is attending an SAEU, that is Honorable Williams. And I want to believe there won't be many of this kind of apologies. Looking forward to that, but I see two hands. I know it's not to apologize, it's something else.
Honorable Dreyer and Honorable Madam Chair, sorry to disappoint you. I've just got the invitation today, this morning, as we arrived here. But I have another portfolio committee meeting on Thursday. I also serve on the Private Members Bill Committee, and they actually have a strategic workshop on Thursday here in Cape Town, and I've already indicated, made a commitment that I will be there. So I'm sorry, I first come first serve, and I will have to attend another one. So if you would please submit my apologies to the minister, but I can't attend the function on Thursday.
I understand that, but I know it won't be the whole TA that won't be there. Honourable Van Skalkwyk.
No, Madam Chair, it appears that it will be the whole TA. Sorry, no, I've got very important, yes, in my constituency. We've got a meeting on Thursday night where I am the speaker. So I won't be able to... Oh, Calvin, yeah. Do you know where that is, Madam Chair? Yeah, it's 430 k's from here.
Takes
me
a day and a half to
go. So please, I want to apologize as well.
I only remember both of you. I really understand your apologies, but we need also a representative from DA, so you have to get somebody somehow who is maybe in Joburg, who resides in Joburg, who can be part of listening on your behalf what has happened to us. I know we want this anti-corruption unit, so try to look into that. Thank you very much, honorable members, and we wish you have a break, but still work. You know that we are going to focus also on local government.